Thank you. Hello, everyone. So, yes, continuing our series that we've been doing for a little while now, called Big Issues, Bigger Kingdom, Money, Sex, Power, and More in the Gospel of Matthew. And just going to jump straight into it. So if you've got a Bible, we're in the Sermon on the Mount still. We're going to finish Matthew chapter 5 today. So Matthew chapter 5, going to read verses 38 through to the end of the chapter. And it says this: "You have heard," this is obviously Jesus speaking, "you have heard the law that says the punishment must match the injury, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, offer the other also. If you are sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. Give to those who ask, and don't turn away from those who want to borrow. You have heard the law that says, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. For he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what reward is there for you? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you're kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." There's lots in this passage today. And I'm only actually going to zoom in on one thing, one verse. But Ian Hare is currently preaching in the City Site on this passage. So I would recommend that you listen to him as well, because he's going to bring out a lot more of the kind of individual application. And also, I would highly, highly recommend the Bible Project podcast series on the Sermon on the Mount, particularly the ones on this passage. They bring out such richness and things from the cultural context that really bring this passage to life in a way that I never understood before. Really beautiful, really rich. So I would really recommend those to you. But one of the aims of this series is to help us navigate through complex cultural issues, to help us understand them, to understand a little bit of how do we navigate them, what should we do, what should we think. And so I'm going to use verse 44 in this passage today, where Jesus says, love your enemies, and I'm going to speak on the topic of war, which I think is a big issue. Big issues, bigger kingdom. So obviously there are the wars that make our headlines on a daily basis in the UK. So Russia and Ukraine still ongoing and intensifying even this week. Then we've got Israel and Palestine and the complexity around all of that. And then there are many, 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 sadly, other wars that don't make our headlines on a daily basis, but are terrible nonetheless. And so I kind of thought, you know what, I don't know when else we get to speak on this topic, if not today, from this passage. So although this passage, Jesus isn't directly speaking about war, and there's all sorts of other things that we could bring out, I kind of think if we're doing a series on big issues and navigating complex cultural moments and issues, then we would probably have to speak on this one at some point. So that's what I'm going to do. It is complex and it is an emotive topic, but I think it is serious enough to warrant deep reflection upon. And I think that Jesus has something to say about it. Oh, I should also say we're going to end with a Q&A or Q&R at the end, because this is complex. So there's the Slido code for those of you who've done this before. If you just go to slido.com on your phone, type in that number, then you can ask questions as I'm speaking, and a little bit later, Rach Tweedale and I will give our best attempts at answering, giving an answer to some of our questions. So have a look at that, and we'll do that a little bit later. So is there a right and wrong answer on war and what Christians should believe and do when it comes to war? What are we supposed to think? What if the UK got swept up in war in a far more immediate sense than it is currently and has been in most of, if not all of, our lifetimes? What should we think? what would we actually do if that happened? So my aim this morning is just to provide a bit more information on the theological positions on war, and then for you all to make your own conclusions based on that. So over the last 2,000 years of Christian theology, really there's only been two theological positions that have been landed upon when it comes to war. Now there are nuances upon each sort of side of the scale, if you like, but really there's only two. And that is, on one side you've got something called the just war tradition, or just war theory, you might have heard of. And then on the other side, you have Christian pacifism. Okay, so I'm going to talk about what both of those include and some of the thinking that goes on behind it. Because actually both of them ultimately hinge on their interpretation of Matthew 5 verse 44 and what it really means in practice in a war situation to love my enemy. What does it mean to love my enemy? Both of them are seeking to answer that question. And I think if the principle of that can be applied to what is perhaps the hardest situation when it comes to loving my enemy in a war situation, then we can sort of bring them down into a more personal context as well. So although this is speaking big scale, actually I think some of these principles can help us in our more normal day-to-day life as well. I'll be honest, I'm not sure there is a right or wrong answer on this. Over the last 2,000 years, there have been some real Christian theological heavyweights on both sides of the debate, and I think there are compelling answers and arguments on both sides. So let's look at just war tradition first of all then, give us a little bit of understanding on what that is. So the just war tradition essentially holds the belief that under certain circumstances and conditions, war is morally justifiable and therefore the right course of action before God. Okay, to take up arms and to go to war. The just war tradition actually began in Greek philosophy rather than Christianity, but quite early on in the Christian church, it was adopted and modified and Christianized essentially in a good way by early church fathers and theologians like Augustine. And then the tradition was developed a lot through the Middle Ages. Okay, by some of you might have heard of Thomas Aquinas, a Christian, massively like heavyweight in the theological world. He really developed the just war tradition in the Middle Ages. So there's a modern day theologian called Daniel Bell, and he writes this. He says, the just war tradition recognizes the divine call, okay, the divine call to use military force as a form of love against enemies as a last resort. That's, in a nutshell, what the just war tradition is. The divine call to take up arms and go to war, use military force as a form of love towards my enemy as a last resort. So, question, how is it loving my enemy to go to war with them? Well, the just war tradition would say the whole aim of going to war is to restore my enemy to peace and to curb their sin. That's how it is loving my enemy, because my desire is to bring them back to peace. So the enemy, my enemy neighbor, as Jesus phrases it here, is the one who is in view. Okay? The motivation to go to war is to bring peace, to restore peace to my enemy, rather than any kind of self-defense, to protect my way of life, to protect our nation, our safety, our flourishing, whatever it may be, at the expense of others. And it's important that, I think, nowhere in the Christian version of the just war tradition is self-defense a legitimate reason to go to war. Rather, it is always about how am I loving my enemy. Passages like Romans 13, 1-4 are important, where Paul speaks about governments and governing authorities being placed by God and being given authority to wield the sword, and that Christians should submit to them. So the just war tradition would say, okay, cool. Well, then if the government says we should go to war, as Christians, we submit to our government and we should go to war in an active way. We should go and join the armed forces and go to war as Christians. That's the right thing to do. That's what the just war tradition says. That's what the Church of England holds as their one of their official articles of religion to this day. That's what it means. There are certain criteria that make up, in this context, what makes a war just? Okay? And there is no one universally agreed upon just war theory. So some of these criteria are up for debate amongst different circles. But importantly, everyone would hold that all of these criteria must be met in order for a war to be just. Okay? All the criteria. There are seven pretty universally agreed upon criteria, and then others in the tradition would add different ones, particularly on how a war is to be concluded and the aftermath of a war, which these seven don't apply to. The first five are the context for a war to be entered into, and then the last two are how to conduct a war once it's actually begun. As I said, others would add ones at the end on how a war is to be concluded and the aftermath of it. So I'm just going to quickly go through what these are. Okay, so this is Christian theology. First of all, for a war to be just, it must be declared by legitimate authorities. Governments, from Romans chapter 13. Okay, governments and authorities like that have, in this tradition, the right to declare war under certain circumstances. I do not. I am not in the right position to do so. However, that does immediately get tricky when you consider sort of guerrilla warfare and coups against oppressive, violent, brutal regimes. That would not count in this tradition as legitimate authority. Next one, just cause. Now, this is the one that we will still hear about on the news. This is the one, really the only one, that is often referred to in an international war context. Okay, so even in the recent history, Saddam Hussein, we think he's got weapons of mass destruction, that's a just cause, we're going to go to war. More recently than that, Iran might get nuclear weapons very soon, so we'll bomb them. Just cause. Okay, that's what's referred to. And it's referred to because there are, obviously, as we know, international laws when it comes to war and what's legal internationally and what's not. And they're based on this. They're based on Christian theology. However, it's never really referred to in the light of like what's morally right before God anymore. It's much more to do with national self-interest, which is never a reason for a Christian to love my enemy and go to war. Okay, so anyway, just cause, that's like the one that you will still hear talked about. Next one, right intent. That's really a heart motive. That my intent is not for self-preservation and self-defense, but rather to love my enemy. That's why I'm going to war. Right intent. Fourth, last resort. Obvious. Has every other means been attempted and exhausted? Diplomatic routes, etc., etc. Is it a last resort? Five, is there a reasonable chance of success? If there's not a reasonable chance of success, we shouldn't go to war. If there is, according to these stated aims, what we're seeking to do, then it could be just. So those five are the conditions upon entering a war for a Christian. If they hold this position, they all must be met. And then the six and the seven is about, as I said, what happens when a war takes place. So number six is non-combatant immunity. What that basically means is that only recognized military targets and personnel are legitimate targets in a war condition. Civilians, innocents, non-combatants must be protected at all costs. And number seven, proportionality, which means only the force required, the minimum force required to achieve the stated aims is allowable in a war context. Okay? That's the tradition, that's the history. I can see how it could be theologically held by someone with a clear conscience before God. There's robust arguments that go behind it. I recommend a book for anyone who's interested. Many real heavyweights in the theological tradition have held this position, and so I can see how you could hold it with a clear conscience before God. However, I do think it's important to ask, in the modern day, in the 21st century, is it actually possible for those seven criteria to be met? And I would argue, no. All criteria must be met in order for a war to be just, according to this Christian theological position, okay? And so if you break one, you break them all. That's the deal. Just like what's written about the law in the Bible. If you break one commandment, you've broken the whole law. It's the same with this, okay? So if you take the last two, non-combatant immunity and proportionality, I don't think that the way war is conducted since the Second World War onwards it would ever, once ever, fit these criteria again. So you have to ask, is it possible, even if you held this position? So very quickly, the number six was non-combatant immunity. That means part of my way to love my neighbour is to love those who have not involved in the military and protect them at all costs. Okay? However, that just isn't the way war is fought anymore. This tradition was developed a lot in the medieval times, right? In the Middle Ages. And the way that wars were conducted then is very, very different to the way wars are conducted now, with this criteria in mind. So in the Middle Ages, the way a war was conducted was my general was going to talk to your general, and we're going to agree that next Tuesday afternoon on that field over there, you bring your army, I'll bring my army, and we'll have a battle. And whoever wins, wins. And all of the non-combatants are safely in their villages and towns, at least in theory. Okay? And so that's the way war was conducted. Today, ever since World War II onwards, it is an accepted military tactic to kill and terrorise a civilian population as much as possible, enough to cause the whole nation to want to surrender. That's actually the way war is conducted now. We see it in the wars that make our headlines every day. And then the last one is proportionality, which says that only the force required, the minimum force required to achieve stated aims, is allowable. But, you know, sadly, weapons technology has progressed so much in the last decades that now really the whole point of many of the bombs and missiles that are used is to create maximum and largely indiscriminate damage with every strike. Okay, that's what you see in Ukraine, right? And Palestine right now is just indiscriminate maximum damage. And that's not even to mention nuclear weapons, whose whole purpose is the threat of such vast and enormous, indiscriminate, disproportionate devastation that would result in their use. That the phrase used for nuclear war in Cold War times was mutually assured destruction, or MAD, which is exactly what it would be. So, as all criteria must be met in this tradition, I think it's no longer possible in the total warfare model that is used today in every war fought to actually ever meet these criteria. And so for me, that means that even if you held this position with a clear conscience before God, you could never actually practice it. So what does that mean for it? I think the tradition does have some positives. Okay, it takes matters of justice and loving my enemy seriously in the most difficult of contexts. And also, I think it calls the church to speak out publicly and humbly on matters of global justice, which is maybe something we should consider slightly more. So that's the just war tradition. That's on one side. Okay, that's one of the two theological positions that the last 2,000 years of Christianity has produced. On the other side is Christian pacifism. Okay, now Christian pacifism holds the belief that Jesus has created a new kingdom and a new humanity to inhabit this kingdom in the midst of the old, fallen and broken world. And this kingdom has a different Lord, has a different value system from the world that exists, and therefore operates on an entirely different paradigm to the rest of the world around us. I think we see this in Jesus' teaching and Jesus' life in different ways. And I think also then we have moments like when Peter asks Jesus, how many times should I forgive someone? As many as seven times? And Jesus says, no, as many as 77 times, or 70 times seven, whichever translation you land upon. Now that is in itself like Peter, you haven't quite understood what's going on. But actually there's a deeper reference to what Jesus is saying here, which goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 4 and a guy called Lamech. Lamech was this violent guy who basically said, if Cain, as in Cain and Abel, Cain killed his brother Abel, if Cain's vengeance is seven times, mine, Lamech's, is 77 times. Okay, so what he's saying is, the method that I'm going to choose to use to achieve my aims is violence. And then Jesus uses the same number when he speaks to Peter. And Peter's like, is it seven times? And Jesus is like, no, forgive 77 times. And it's an immediate reference back to Lamech. And he's basically saying, I'm creating a whole new type of humanity right here on earth that doesn't operate by the world's value system, but rather operates in an otherworldly new kingdom value system. A new kingdom has arrived. The old way of operating is being undone. War, and indeed I think violence of any kind in this context, would be seen as colluding with the powers, with a capital P, that Paul writes about in Ephesians and elsewhere, the demonic spiritual forces of evil behind the world around us that we see. Any kind of war or violence is sort of colluding with those powers that Jesus came to destroy and did put them to open shame at the cross. Now, there's a problem with pacifism, and that is that the word sounds like passive. But actually, the words are not related in any way, okay? But what pacifists can be accused of is essentially shirking their responsibility. He's saying, well, you know, you pacifists, you'll just stand at the back and just not do anything and let other people fight your wars for you. You're not carrying your load, your responsibility. You're passive. But actually, true Christian pacifism can, and I think probably should, be an active position. You've got the next slide, Toby. Beautifully epitomized and embodied by the late and very great Dr. Martin Luther King, okay, who, as you all know, led the civil rights movement in the US in the 60s. And his position was this, was active nonviolence. No one could accuse him or those he led of passivity when it came to the civil rights movement. He took a stand, or rather often took a seat, as a non-violent way to oppose, to stand against the evil that was the racism that plagued the United States then and in many ways still does. It was an active position. He wasn't just going, I don't believe in taking up arms. He went what he did and what they did really was a willingness to take up their cross and to show the inhumanity that was being conducted. It's like earlier when Jesus says, you're kind of heaping coals on your enemy's head. By just sitting there and not taking up arms and allowing evil to be done to them, the point was to show it as idiocy and evil that it was. And I think you could argue that Martin Luther King's way of fighting for the civil rights, in the civil rights movement, was more effective than its counterparts led by people like Malcolm X, who instead sought to meet violence with violence. You know, it's totally understandable as another way of fighting that evil. But I think you could argue that active nonviolence was ultimately more effective, as history tells the story. So it is a willingness to take up my cross, to live in this new kingdom, even in the face of evil and violence, even if it means suffering myself to the point of giving my own life. Jesus instructed his people to love, forgive, and bless their enemies. But beautifully, he didn't just talk the talk, did he, Jesus? He very much walked the walk to the infinite extent where he hung upon a cross and he said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. This is what loving my enemy looks like in this position, Christian pacifism, a willingness to put myself in harm's way intentionally without taking up arms, without responding violence with violence, as a witness to a different kingdom that operates in a different paradigm that has already come and is one day going to come in all its completion, even if it costs me my own life. It has to do with the timeline that we believe we inhabit, where our hope truly lies. This position is a demonstration that my hope is not in this life. My hope is not in trying to achieve a temporary peace even in this world right now, but rather pointing towards, even if it costs me my life, pointing towards a kingdom that is coming one day in all its fullness, where there will be beautiful peace forever and ever and ever. I think in some ways this is the harder path than taking up arms and going to war. Not that there's an easy route in either. Okay, so those are the two positions. Just war tradition, Christian pacifism, which is not passive, but rather active non-violence. To land, I think a helpful further sort of consideration for Christians for what we should think when it comes to matters of war and what do we do and all that kind of thing, is that ultimately being a Christian is a matter of allegiance. We actually sang in one of the songs, paraphrasing Romans 10 verse 9, where it says, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Confessing with your mouth that Jesus is Lord is a statement of allegiance. Right? So the question is there a place for Christians to show allegiance to their country, to their nation, as well as to Jesus? And if so, what does that look like? Because I think there is a place in the story of the Bible for celebrating diversity, ethnic nationalities, right? From the beginning to the end, right at the end in Revelation, it talks about the kings of the nations bringing their glory into the New Jerusalem. And I always picture the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games with that verse, of like these different nations coming in their different national dress and dancing in different ways and all that. And it's like a representation of the beautiful diversity that is the human race. And that requires difference and nationalities to be celebrated, ethnicities to be celebrated. I think there is a place for celebrating that in the biblical story. However, I think maybe Matthew 22, verse 15 to 22, is the most helpful bit to go to, story to go to, when it comes to matters of allegiance and what we're supposed to think. And that is, I won't read it now, but that is when someone asks Jesus, shall we pay taxes? And he says, well, show me a coin, show me a denarii. Whose image and likeness is on this? Caesar's. And he says, okay, well then render to Caesar what is Caesar's, but render to God what is God's. And the important bit in that is the question of whose image does this thing bear? Okay? So as far as it goes, yeah, sure, give the image of Caesar to Caesar. That can be his. But you bear the image of God. So you render to God what is God's. And that is the beautiful tight, not even tightrope, the beautiful wisdom of Jesus in that moment, which shut them all up. And they decided from then on not to ask him any more questions because they were hoping to trap him. But what he was, and it was a political question, trying to get him to say something that would get him in trouble with Rome or with the Jewish authorities so that they could kill him. And what he did masterfully was basically say, no, obey the authorities, no problem. To a point, but ultimately at one point when the authorities are asking you to do something that goes against God, you obey God. It's just a spectacular answer, and I think helps us here when it comes to this question of allegiance. We are called to obey governing authorities to a point, I think. And I think that requires discernment. So any allegiance that we might have to our nation, to our people group, whatever it may be, as a Christian, should be a secondary allegiance to Christ. Yeah? Jesus is Lord. He is my first allegiance. Under that primary allegiance, I can have secondary, less important allegiances to other things. And I think celebrating nations and differences culturally is a beautiful part of the Christian story. And one day we'll see it in all its beauty forever and ever and ever. Ultimately, Paul says in Ephesians 6, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers, with a capital P, of this dark world and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Right now, on this day, we are not at war as a nation. Okay? There's no guarantees in this life. And so I do think this kind of thing is worth considering. But I also think if we can consider it and work out a little bit of what we think in what is maybe the most difficult context, to love my enemy, then as I said at the beginning, we can bring that down into more daily life as well. There's other things, loads of other things we could say on this. Maybe some of it will come out as we do Q&R in a moment. But Jesus' command here in Matthew 5, verse 44, is love your enemies. What does that look like? Wonderfully, Jesus didn't just say it. He then did it. Because the truth of the gospel is that we all were those enemies that he loved to the end. And so then he has the right, as those who confess him as Lord, to call us to take up our crosses and to do the same. And I think for those who have been directly affected by war, either people who've maybe served in the armed forces and often trauma that people live with after those events, or those who have experienced war as, you know, as a refugee maybe, or become a refugee because of it, the gospel, the cross, is the only place where people can process that and be brought into true freedom, I believe. Healing, forgiveness, all of that, I think is only possible in the cross. Our friend Bernard, from originally Bosnia-Herzegovina, he was here a few months ago, and we all met at the city site. You know, he wasn't a Christian when the atrocious war in that part of the world happened in the 1990s. He fought in the war, and then he became a Christian soon after. And one of the things God spoke to him about was dealing with hatred in his heart, because this is the phrase that he felt God say, the seeds of the next war are still in your heart, Bernard. So he had to bring his experiences to the cross, and he found mercy and was able to give mercy, and then built and led a church made up of the very people groups who were at once at war with each other. Just beautiful. This is what Jesus came to do. This is what the gospel can do. I'll finish with a quote and then we'll do some questions. This is a great quote, and this isn't particularly trying to push just war or pacifism, but this is just saying where our ultimate hope lies. It says this: the reason why the cross is good news is that the early church recognized it as the last sacrifice, the one that finally took away sin and became the death of war. The sacrifice of the Son of God is the sacrifice to end all sacrifice. So the war to end all wars was not the Civil War or the First or the Second World War. It was the cross. The dividing wall of hostility between us and God has tumbled down. The good news of the cross is fundamentally that war is over. One day that will be wonderfully true in the entire cosmos because of the sheer mercy and grace of the King of Kings.